Okay, we're now going from multiculturalism to horticulturalism, and we want to discuss Australian landscape design. This is going to be dead dangerous. There'll be blood on the carpet here. There's a lot of social or soul searching over the years for an Australian design ethos. And landscape gardener Michael Bates is searching for design that is characteristically Australian. Michael argues that our landscape design ethos should be based on Australian landforms, soils and flora. And I've got to say, I've got to admit my bigotry and my prejudice, I'm with Michael. Because where we're trying to do a garden, you can't do anything else anyway, because of the vicissitudes of the weather. But he's not a purist. Earlier tonight he was extolling the virtues of casuarinas in Vietnam, which had been shaped by French pruning methods. Dear, oh dear. But he does feel that in this stage in our history we should be secure enough in who we are to make a strong national statement about our character through our landscape design. Now, our second guest, on the other hand, argues for an inclusive design ethos, one that makes room for a range of meanings and values placed by different groups on the land. Helen Armstrong is a lecturer in the School of Landscape Architecture at the Uni of New South Wales, and she feels that a design ethos based around Indigenous plants excludes the riches on offer from the many migrant cultures who've graced our shores. Helen, I can remember about 10 or 15 years ago, there was a loony rushing around the Adelaide Hills, ring-barking pine trees as a political statement. That's how extreme it can get, isn't it?
You're right. There's this kind of eco-fascism.
Eco-fascism, that's right. And finally, we've got David Tacey, Dr. David Tacey, who, of course, wrote Edge of the Sacred. David stuck on his own, on his Pat Malone down in Melbourne. David, I think, sees a middle way, thank heavens, between monoculture and rampant pluralism, and he thinks that we will slowly but surely find the more subtle threads which link us, and our gardens will follow suit. Michael, we are, I think, fellow Republicans, are we not?
Yes, I think we are, Philip.
Why isn't the microphone working, Manny? Let me ask you that. Are you a Republican?
Yes, Philip, I am a Republican.
And there should be a Republican garden, shouldn't there?
I think so. I think that gardens could function as the web that weaves us all together, no matter what backgrounds or angles or attitudes or value systems.
And we've had enough of this horticultural imperialism, haven't we?
We certainly have.
The POMs imposing their wretched little gardens on us.
Yeah.
Their roses and everything. Yeah. Which then go feral and wreck the landscape.
Yes, yes. Very tacky copies. I think that we've got to sort out what's a suitable
You're also a drunken Republican.
And what's a cheap copy? And what's a, you know, whether or not it made any sense when it was first put together in its original synthesis.
Michael, can I confess to a difficulty here? I'm sometimes not absolutely sure, however, when I look at plants, whether they're Australian or not. How can we be sure? I mean, you probably know, don't you, because you know them all.
Well, no. That's a valid point, because if you come from Darwin or you come from Melbourne, you're living in a totally different ecosystem and a totally different landscape. And that's the point exactly, is that perhaps we could be a little bit more sensitive to our different regions and be inspired from the landscape itself. So
you're also a regionalist. You think it's wrong to bring plants from the wrong region and transplant.
Well, I don't think it's just about the plants. It's really about the whole picture. And all too often people drag the debate straight into the plants and say it's about Australian plants. And it's not. It's about a whole lot of things. It's about the way we relate to the landscape.
I had a guy on last night who's written a book on short people. Very, very solemn, serious American academic who points out that tall people are environmentally unsound. They consume too much of everything. And if you're 6 foot as opposed to 4 foot, 5 foot, one extra foot, you wear 44% more clothing. Now, I'm wondering about the other argument, because when you, in fact, have foreign plants in an arid country like this, you've got to give them too much water, haven't you?
Yes, yes, and the lawns as well. You know, perhaps we could be thinking about aggregates and compacted and loose aggregates as substitutes to lawns, and think about mitigating the amount of lawn area that we have down, just so, you know, so the kids can run and play and the dogs can have a go. And
if you're up the bush like we are and you're surrounded by the natural landscape, would you sort of blend that right up to the house, or would you permit a little sort of contrapuntal oasis just around the homestead?
Well, again, it really depends on the exact site and its qualities and characteristics and what you actually wanted to use it for. Because I'm not advocating the bush garden. I'm not advocating that we all want to live in the bush. We don't. In fact, the majority of us live in urban settings and suburban settings. So I don't think that it's about bush gardens. I think it's about doing something which is Australian, and that would naturally encourage you to use, you know, the local plant material. But
is there a place for the garden gnome in your vision, Splendid?
Oh, yes, I think so.
There is, right. How long is this eco-fascism sort of we're discussing here?
Well, I think the story's more complicated than this. I mean, I don't disagree with Michael entirely.
With him entirely. It's more fun.
I know it's more fun. And I certainly don't disagree with David. I think what he says is marvellous.
Yeah, but David's sitting down there waiting to be included. Don't worry, David, we're getting to you.
But I think the story is richer and more interesting than just using the regional plants in their setting. And I think it's even more interesting in Australian terms.
Well, because of multiculturalism?
That's an interesting one. No, I think it's just our own cultural history, which is multicultural right from the beginning. 1788, it was multicultural, reveals that we had a very interesting affinity with Australian plants and other plants right from the beginning. I mean, people arrived here in 1788 with a good knowledge of Australian plants because of Banks' collection.
Because of Banks, of course,
But they brought with them...
Who had given kangaroos to Nepal...
Marie Antoinette.
To Marie Antoinette, yes. And they were hopping around
there were six plants which were taken to England and cultivated and flowered before the first fleet arrived.
That's correct. But I think the interesting thing is that the first fleet also brought oaks from Cape Town, and they also brought stone pines from Rio de Janeiro. And these were planted in our public landscape very early. Now, of course, being settled in Sydney, the oaks didn't do too well because of the poor soils. So then the explorers collected trees that looked rather similar, like the Moreton Bay fig. And indigenous tree to Sydney.
It's not an indigenous tree?
No.
And really?
Absolutely.
It's nothing
not.
Sacred. I just assumed it was.
No.
It was Ridgey Didge.
It comes from Moreton Bay.
I think it's also important to tell the listener, whose name is Gladys, that even the English garden, of course, was already multicultural because the great botanists had wandered around the world, hadn't they, and brought plants back from India and China and South America.
Well, if Michael points out, the issue was not just plants. The great gardeners of the 18th century England went to Italy to learn about style.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was always multicultural.
Now, David, stuck down in your booth in Melbourne, where do you stand on all this? Do you want to encourage both streams of consciousness here?
I think so. I think both dynamics are very important in Australian culture and history. The notion that we are promoting something which is a unity or some sort of common thread or a republican sentiment, as we might want to call it now, or promoting something which is basically a celebration of difference and differences. And I think that really the history of Australian culture has been a kind of a contest, hasn't it, between those two things. And at various stages of our history, one tends to become uppermost, the other one goes into sort of disappears out of view. I think at the moment we're in a phase of enormous celebration of difference. Difference is beaut, difference is terrific, and a lot of people do look with a great deal of suspicion at anybody who's wanting to promote some kind of uniformity across the culture. But the uniformity is important because difference, while creating diversity and colour and all those things that we're told in multicultural discourse, it's true, but similarity is needed. Otherwise, we don't really have a common thread or a core, no focused energy, which you could call a nation.
Michael, you don't have a museum attitude, do you, towards Australian plants? You're into experimenting and hybridising.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's the big problem, is that people don't see that we could impose some of those French,
tell us about the Vietnamese pruning technique.
Yeah, that's fantastic. There's a little resort in Vietnam called Nha Trang, which the Russians used to go and visit, apparently, and I didn't see them. But they had these casuarinas, and they were planted, mass-planted, about 17 in 3 or 4 square metre area, and they pleached them. Which is basically pleach them, which is a French pruning technique where you trim them at the top you raise the crown, so you pull all the little branches off up until you get this massive foliage.
Sounds like a poodle cut.
Yes, it is. Yeah, similar. But
you can't say anything French is good at the moment, Michael.
No. It's a pruning technique. I don't think
this
they
is live to air. We can't edit that out, can we, Michael's kind references to the French?
Yes, well, you know, I showed it to some bush regenerator friends, an image of this, and they thought it was perverse. But I think it's quite an exciting idea. And I think that we should be trying to do new things. Look at the plants and what they have, how they've adapted to fire and how they've adapted to being disturbed. And look at coppicing and look at mass planting of things that you wouldn't ordinarily think about doing.
So you're at one level, you're talking about big landscape effects, aren't you? You're talking about big brush stuff.
Yeah, well, in some senses, yeah, there's broad strokes. But to give you an example, today I planted 36 angiophoras in a suburban front yard.
You did not.
A metre and a half apart.
You couldn't.
Hey? Now Helen's laughing.
They'll never be able to get the dustbins out.
That's the sort of thing I did in the 70s, and now I run away from it.
Yeah. One of the great things that happened in the 70s was people planted giant gums in the world's smallest gardens in Carlton. It was like Jack and the Beanstalk, and you look up and there's a terrace house 500 feet in the air.
Yes, well, it's a little bit more advised these days. We test the soils and we have a look at what the regional vegetation is and have a better guess. But there's all sorts of things that can be done, and I think that your Australian viewer isn't really going to get the sense of wonderment from this great landscape, except for the great viewing points where you go and you ooh and ah at Kakadu and all the great the things to look at, isn't going to get that sense back home, victoring the front lawn and washing the Holden in the driveway.
Michael, you learned from a Japanese landscape architect as well, or got some hints that you thought were applicable?
Well, personally, I learned a great deal of things about proportion and size and placement of objects within the landscape. But moreover, I really gained a great sense of how the value, just having a sense of having the landscape as being a really important part of life, going and sitting under a cherry blossom and sipping sake. And that was a fantastic, fantastic thing. And it's because a gardener went through and planted all these, cherry blossoms, and then all these other gardeners started doing it. Before you know it, there was that unifying element. But
Helen, Michael's describing one of the most excruciatingly intense monocultures on earth, isn't he?
Yes.
The Japanese.
Yes.
And that, we're not like that, are we?
Well, we do have a curious and diverse flora, and I think this is obviously extraordinary, but we also have a curious and diverse culture. And I think that there are very subtle things that diversity of culture has produced over time. And I agree with David that there is at the moment a great sort of focus on diversity, and that is actually not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the very complex and intriguing cultural history that we have.
Well, tell the listener about some of the things that arrived early, because I didn't know.
You didn't
willow
know?
Slips and
yes.
Cocoa and everything?
Yes. Well, all of those staples. You see, one of the things that did arrive early and continues to arrive is the desire to experiment with plants. And I think that also applies to Australian plants. And many of the immigrant groups, whether they're Anglo-Celts or from somewhere else, have this intriguing interest with the way in which plants will be acclimatized here, whether they're Australian or not Australian. Now, I think the stone pines were quite fascinating. They were planted in a great avenue down Bridge Street. And they were taken out, I guess, about the 1880s, 1890s.
Aww.
And the Moreton Bay figs were planted all along Macquarie Street right through Hyde Park and were taken out when one of the directors of the Botanic Gardens decided that we should look more tropical and introduce the Canary Island palms. So, there's a very intriguing history with the love of the rainforest tree, whether it's Australian or introduced.
David, of course, migrants want to bring their flora here, don't they, so they feel at home. But paradoxically, they're probably the ones who see what is the differences in Australia most clearly.
That's interesting. Somebody did a study a couple of years ago about dreams, and they said the only people who dream about kangaroos and emus and parrots were in fact migrants because they noticed, they registered these differences.
Yes, when we Australians see a kangaroo bouncing down Collins Street, we just take it for granted.
But it is true that the migrant person is doing two things at once. They're like a snail they're bringing home with them, aren't they? And they're setting up shop and they're trying to reproduce the social and political moral reality of home, but they're also trying to adjust to what is new. And I think that that often happens only after, of course, economic security has been achieved. I think that's the first thing that people want. And when that security, when that economic basis is secure, then they can start getting out of the shell, breaking out of it and asking questions about where are we.
Oh, David, so it's a very interesting time. I disagree with you about that.
It's getting nasty now, isn't it? They're getting savage with each other here.
One of the fundamental things that happens through the process of migration is the need to actually create a garden. And I've been working with different immigrant groups in inner Sydney, and they tell me that the way in which you can, for instance, recognise a Greek area is by the garden, because of the compelling need to grow the food with which you're familiar, and that's one of the most urgent things you have to do.
It's not enough of an answer. You can't just say,
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, that's what I said about reproducing your home environment and doing that. But also, in that reproduction is something subtle, and that's what I'm interested in. That is to say, all these different cultures come here, implant themselves on the soil. Many people think that what they've done is simply imported artificially from abroad, but you do see subtle things developing which indicate that there is an Australianisation that has gone on. And that's the kind of Australianisation I guess I'm interested in. I'm a little bit suspicious of anything which is too boastful and strident.
Well, let me ask you this, Helen. Was there a time in another culture when things did get a bit boastful and strident? This is to prompt you to talk about Germany in the 30s.
Dear. Well, can I pick up on something that I agree with, David? And I think what is intriguing is this sort of migrant experience. What I think is that there's a first garden, and that first garden is the garden of survival. And then, as you say, when one is more established, then there are what I call new world exuberances. And the Anglo-Celtic migrants did that, you know, by building Norman castles in the 1820s in places like Marrickville. And then today we often see, you know, second or third generation Italian gardens, which are very exuberant expressions of Italian culture. But to get back to your
question, Germany, yes. Something to warn Michael and
yes,
I about here?
I think that there is a very real concern. I mean, Heidegger is an example to us of where blood and soil are equated with nationalism. I think that there is this worry about the need to create a strongly nationalistic representation in the landscape and not allow for difference. And I think in Germany in the 1930s and 40s, the landscape planners were the ones who insisted that the only German landscape was one that had no foreign elements in it at all, whether they were people or plants.
They did some heavy pruning, did they?
They certainly did.
Out of the wellies into the jackboots. Right. Mm.
But,
oh dear.
But I'm not actually talking about it.
What's the armband you're wearing there, Michael?
I'm not actually talking about the, you know, somebody at home in Darwin and somebody at home in Tasmania having the same garden.
Talk to the microphone.
Regional sensitivity is what it's all about, and it's not about a national fervour or anything else, because not at all. Because if I was living in California or I was living in Florence, I would be talking about the regional aspects regarding that particular place.
So regionalism trumps nationalism in your garden?
Absolutely.
So you're not a fascist?
No.
You're a Republican?
Absolutely.
A good Australian lad?
And I mean, everybody's talking about subtle things. So how about we talk about some sort of upfront things? What about Floriade? I mean, we talked about New Holland plants, and that's what Australian plants were called in 1771 when the first batch went over to Kew Gardens. They were called New Holland plants, and they were called that all the way through, you know, to the 1850s when they sort of dropped out. Now, what is Floriade if it isn't New Holland plants? I mean, all of these tulips put up in mounds. How is that Australian, and why is it so popular?
Why is it so popular, Helen?
Oh, why is it so popular? Well, I think a lot of it's to do with that sort of escapist fantasy and also the immediacy. I think one of the problems that Australian plants have is that they're not spectacular en masse, unless there's impeded drainage and you get a colourful swamp. In general, you've got this sort of intricate flora, and you need to engage with the
dull greys, haven't you, and strange greens.
Well, it depends. I mean, if you go to a wet gully and have a look around there, you could be in heaven.
Oh, look, I'm not criticising, but it's a different feeling, different sort of colour.
You certainly don't get spectacle in the way that the mass of planting of tulips creates.
Yeah, David, we're running out of time. I want to ask David a big one here. David, there's a vogue, of course, these days for appropriating Aboriginal relationships to the land and Aboriginal motifs, Aboriginal just about everything. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think it's a double-edged sword, really, isn't it? About, like, this questions of unity. The Aboriginal issue is obviously looms enormously large for Australian culture, and we've got to get it right. But I think the thing is that a lot of thinking Australians want to be sensitive toward Indigenous culture and Aboriginality, and they want to show that sensitivity in acts and behaviour and whatever.
And but the garden?
And the garden.
Bit of fire stick farming.
Which is part of the same thing. But the showing of our sensitivity can, I think, end up being just showy and artificial. And also, as far as Aboriginal culture is concerned, I think our gestures, as we see them, can be read as insensitive appropriations of Indigenous Australian culture.
Michael, you've sat under a cherry tree in Japan. Yeah. Have you sat under a eucalypt and talked about gardens, seriously, with Aborigines?
With Aborigines?
Yeah.
No.
I'm wondering how they'd feel about...
About what I'm talking
about?
Yeah, well, this is just one little white guy's... young white man impressions about what it is to live in Australia today. It's not about 50,000 or years of connection to the place, but it's about starting out today and looking forward from what has been done, both white and Indigenous history, and trying to make the next step a good step.
Listen, also, Aboriginal culture was not a monoculture. It was a very diverse culture. There were several hundred language groups here. So the notion that multiculturalism started with Captain Cook is a fallacy, actually. Australia has been a multicultural society from dot.
Normally on this program, of course, we have extremely temperate, well-mannered discussions, almost to the point of catatonic states. But tonight, gardening has triggered off this brawl, this unseemly brawl, and they've all behaved disgracefully, waving implements at each other. The voices of Michael Bates, landscape gardener, and presenter, I should have said, of the gardening segment on Saturday National. I didn't say that, did I?
Before. No.
Naughty Philip. Helen Armstrong, lecturer in the School of Landscape at the University of New South Wales. Lovely to see you again, Helen. David Tacey, director of the Centre for Archetypal Studies at La Trobe University. We must talk one night about what exactly the Centre of Archetypal Studies does, David.
Yes, indeed.